Amen.
And Judges chapter 9 this evening. This is the longest chapter in the book of Judges. The Bramble King, that's the title of this ninth chapter. It's the story of a thug politician. And you'll only find those kind of politicians in the Old Testament. You wish. Abimelech, that's his name. He was power-crazed, the power-crazed son of Gideon, the man of God. He was homicidal, not Gideon, Abimelech, a bloodthirsty despot is what he really was. And he wanted to be king so badly that he massacred 69 of his 70 brothers at one time. And what we have in this ninth chapter concerning his life, and it will contain to this ninth chapter, are three stages of his political life. And it is his seizing of power. He really can't say the kingdom, though he considered himself a king. The defense of his power, and then the loss of it. He was not anointed by God, and he was illegitimate among men. As in relation to his authority, but also in his beginnings. And we got some of that last chapter, chapter 8, that he was the son of Gideon through Gideon and his concubine. Now, the ninth chapter strongly suggests that the concubine was a Shechemite, in other words, a Gentile. A Canaanite, you could say. And so let's look into verse 1. Then Abimelech, the son of Jerubbabel, that is Gideon, went to Shechem to his mother's brothers and spoke with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying. Now, before we get to what he is saying, his name means my father is king. We can speculate on how that came about because Gideon refused to be king, though he lived like a king as far as all of the niceties that surrounded his life. He was very wealthy, and he had a very large harem. And Abimelech, my father is king, it went to his head at some point. He felt he should be king. He was like the crown prince who should have been but wasn't in his thinking. And so he goes to Shechem. Now, his mother's from Shechem. Evidently, he was born and raised there and moved away, but remained closely related. And he's not living in his hometown, but he comes to Shechem. And his mother's brothers, obviously his uncles. He recruits his uncles to launch his campaign to become leader. And he's using Shechem to launch his political career. Verse 2, before I read verse 2, I'll just add this comment. Right now, the sons of Gideon, his 70 sons, or a portion thereof, were the political leaders of this region in Israel under Manasseh's territory. And spilling out, we would think, we don't get a lot of details. And we have to go by how the story reads. And because there's no summoning of the tribes, it lends us gives us a hint that he's pretty local in power. But verse 2, please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbabel reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember that I am your own flesh and bone. So you could listen to this and say, you know, this is kind of boring. This is just a story of what was happening to people years ago. This has been acted out throughout history globally. But of course, the Holy Spirit preserves precisely what he wants. And from that, he cherry picks as we need, or at some time that we will need to draw from the lessons, points that he wants to make to us. And in this case, this Bramble King Abimelech, he's just a troublemaker. Oh, every church should have one. Every home should have one. Every city should have a share of troublemakers. And how quickly these things just come to be. And so here he's using his campaign. Please speak, in verse 2, in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. He's saying this to his uncles. He's saying, go to the leaders of the city and get them to make me king. And so his rationale, which is better for you? As though he had the people in mind. That all 70 of the sons of Jerubbabel reign over you, or that one reign over you. Which is better? You want 70 people that you know leading you? Just want one. Really doesn't make a difference. It depends on who they are. It's not a numerical problem. It's a moral issue. But that's his pitch, his campaign slogan. 1 or 70. And of course, he wants to be the chief of the mob of family members who I'm sure they're saying to themselves, well, if we make Abimelech king, then it's going to be good for us. We're going to get benefits too. And so his argument again is, do you want the out-of-towners to rule over you, those Jewish children of Gideon who happen to have brought us 40 years of peace, or do you want a hometown boy, your homie, to be the ruler over you? He says, remember that I am your own flesh and bone. No, that's lame. Those are not credentials. Again, we have peace right now. Why are we changing anything? And how come just because you're related to us, you somehow deserve to rule? And that's why I think their motives were selfish. They were saying, yeah, you know, we put him in power. We're going to benefit from this. He'll take care of us and we'll take care of him. And this self-esteem leading to self-promotion, in contrast to being anointed as Gideon was. Hebrews chapter 5, speaking about the office of the high priest, or the priesthood. The writer says, and no man takes this honor to himself, but he who is called by God, just as Aaron was. And that is the principle of serving the Lord. Are you appointed to this by the Lord or not? And a competitive spirit must be resisted if you work in ministry. And it creeps up so quickly. We get so, you know, again, if you hear about somebody who excels in their profession, you applaud them. Unless you share the profession. Then what do you mean? You're saying he's a better doctor than me? What are you saying? He's a better carpenter than I am? And so we have to watch those things. When I was a welding inspector, I would joke, rarely, I learned to not do this, but I would joke with some of the guys that were really good welders. They didn't know I was joking. I would say, who did this weld over here? Who put this on here? And they get very defensive because they were very interested in laying down a perfect weld. And any criticism, you better be ready to back it up. And so I learned, well, I better stop doing that. It's cute to me, but they didn't like it. Anyway, in the verse 3, and his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem, and their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he's our brother. Doesn't matter if he's incompetent. Nepotism, it is disgusting. If you've ever been a victim of it, somebody allows their family to make your life miserable because they're family. They get to be the supervisor, incompetent and counterproductive, irritating, and all the things that go with it because they're family. If you've ever worked in a family business, you may have been subjected to that. Well, he's my son, and so, you know, he's going to get it, and you're going to get it. If it's bad, I mean, sometimes it works out well. So he sold the idea and to the men of Shechem. Again, the men of Shechem, a mixed bunch, Jews and Gentiles, belong to this city. The Shechemites are descendants of Hamor, who, you remember the story of Simeon and Levi going in and slaughtering them. Well, there were survivors, and there are people that claim to be connected. Not everybody was home when the slaughter took place, evidently, to have survivors. Verse 4. So they gave them 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Beeroth, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Something similar happened in the book of Acts, where they tried to hinder the work of the apostles. They hired those lesser men of the baser sort, says the king, the old King James Version, very poetically. Well, these men were base men, lesser men of the base sort, worthless and reckless men. May we not be that way. And so he receives not only authority, but he has the finances to launch this massacre that he has in mind. Isaiah 59:7, their feet run to evil and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. They're just selfish. They're all about them. They don't care what they do. And this is Abimelech. It says from the temple of Beeroth, one of the idols. It's an idol-based initiative. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 11, he makes this statement. He says, he commits offense, ascribing his power to his God. Well, his God wills it. It must be right. It comes right down from his temple. It's God's will. And who can be in the way of that? Well, I have the money to be king from the temple. So this must be blessed because he's no connection to Yahweh and Abimelech is ever made. And an unbeliever can serve 8 of the 10 commandments if they get rid of the first 2 commandments. Not take the Lord's name in vain as this mock morality or mock religion. They cannot kill and steal and those things on the surface outside. But they're not. They have other gods. They have idols. And this is Abimelech. He has another god. He has images of his god. He's not following the first 2 letters of the 10 commandments. And then he will go on and break as many of the others as he can. But sometimes we come across people that they on the surface, they're decent people. They may be very religious people. But when it comes to truly serving God, the first 2 commandments have been compromised. And that allows them to serve God in their own way. We see whole religions do this. You can buy your way out of guilt. You can write a check and be forgiven. And they will make it official for you. You can light a candle for somebody who's dead. And somehow they're going to be blessed by the burning wax and wick. These can get away with this because they run in a group that really the first 2 commandments don't really count. So, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men and they followed him. These are gangsters on the payroll. In those days, there was no CNN or MSNBC to have on your side. You had to take matters into your own hands with a sword, and that is what they're going to do. The old saying, show me your friends and I'll show you your future. These are the friends of Abimelech. These gangsters, and we'll find out what they're up to. Verse 5, then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbabel, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbabel, was left because he hid himself. Loosely referred to the 70 sons. We see this in the New Testament with the 12 apostles. Because the 70th, of the number escaped. The youngest one, he hid himself. And this killing the competition was not a metaphor with Abimelech. It was a reality. Again, Habakkuk, he says, woe to him who builds a town with bloodshed, who establishes a city by iniquity. Well, that's what he's doing. He felt entitled. He's, again, the prince that should have been and never was. And it just bothered him too much. To usurp the definition from Webster's Dictionary, one of them, there's like 20 editions. There's a collegiate, a different kind. There's the grocery store, anyway. To seize and hold as office, place, or powers in possession by force or without right. And he's doing it by force and he is doing it without right. He is usurping the authority. He has massacred 69 men. How much grief was upon that village and Ophrah because of this maniac, 70 sons of Jerubbaal. That is, of course, Gideon. Let Baal answer for himself. And so he's now a graduate of Satan's School for Dictators. It is a growing alumni. It has been expanding over the centuries. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 12. It is an abomination for kings to commit wickedness, for a throne is established by righteousness. Well, too bad you didn't write that earlier, Solomon, so that Abimelech could have got read that and he would have behaved. Unfortunately, it's not that way for the wicked. For the righteous, it is. But Jotham, the youngest, again, he survived, the one survivor, verse 6. And all the men of Shechem gathered together at Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. This blood-soaked coronation, they gathered together to make Abimelech king. Some kingdom. Again, highly doubtful that his influence reached much beyond Manasseh, if it even reached throughout Manasseh. His mother, as I mentioned, was a Shechemite. His father, of course, Gideon, was Jewish. And that allowed him to have influence with the Gentiles in Shechem and the Jews outside of Shechem, as well as the ones that were there also. And he could comfortably, more comfortably, according to his logic, represent both sides. Well, both sides were doing fine without him. We don't read about a problem until he comes along. He is the problem. And this place in Shechem, at Shechem, you know, with much Jewish history there. Abraham, of course, had an altar there. Joshua pronounces the blessings on the people and gathers the people to Shechem before the end of his days. Jacob buried the idols that were in his caravan there at Shechem. And this tree that is referenced here is likely associated with the patriarchs. This makes the crime even worse, a mockery. And it is that ecumenical thing that satisfies the Gentiles because they have their pagan image there. And it satisfies the Jews who are sitting on the fence with their religion because it is connected to the patriarchs. Verse 7, now when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and cried out and said to them, listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. It's a nice introduction. Maybe if he was speaking extemporaneously, just right out, or if he wrote this down, he published it at some point. Somebody said, this is good stuff. And preserved it. It's a wonder. He's going to give this parable that is a scathing rebuke on these wicked men. Now, his name, God is Perfect. And apparently a godly man. We wish we knew more about him because there's so much coming out of his parable. In preparation, I'm saying to myself, I don't know if there's so much to take out of the parable. I don't know if we'll finish the chapter because it may take up some of the time. Not on paper. It's if the Lord just gives me stuff, or if I feel he does. Anyway, Mount Gerizim. That's where Israel was supposed to pronounce the blessings on the people of God for obedience. And Mount Ebal, across from it, was where the other half of the tribes would pronounce the judgments and curses upon the people for not honoring God's word. Well, Jotham uses Mount Gerizim, which should have been the Mount of Blessing, to curse those who had forsaken God and slaughtered his brothers. And it shows how far, by doing this, he shows how far Israel had fallen from obedience and integrity and honor. And it is actually quite symbolic. Abimelech would have known that, but it just wouldn't have mattered. He was that rotten a person. Verse 8, the trees once went forth, now he begins his parable, to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. Now this is the first recorded parable in the Bible. And of course parables are in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. They are timeless illustrations, very beneficial. and they take some concrete situation and they cast it in an abstract, you know, sort of light that ends up, or kind of like abstract concept, and it ends up being concrete, solid, something you can say, yes, I see it, and you don't forget it easily. Ezekiel and Daniel, in their ministries, they used trees to make their point to the nation before Nebuchadnezzar. And so we have Jotham doing the same thing. He's using these trees. He starts off with the olive tree. These fruit trees are nominated. That's where he's going with this. He's saying the olive tree, the vine, the fig tree, the olive, fig, and vine, they represent those nominated to rule over them, those fruitful people to rule over them. That's where he's going with this. The fruit-bearing trees were those who fulfilled the needs in life. They made a contribution to life. And then in a society where, you know, the harvest and the animals dictated the rhythm, people were very in touch with these things. Now the grocery stores do it for us. What time do they open? But these trees that he's giving as an example, they're not looking to do anything else but bear their fruit. Unlike Abimelech. Spurgeon writes about this in preaches about this in one of his sermons. He says, they strove to win over those better trees which had remained faithful. So now look at it in this light. You have someone who is very fruitful in life, and someone wants that person to run for political office, to stop being fruitful and come lead us in this office. And their response of the olive tree type character, no, what I am doing here is very important. I'll get back to that as we color in more the parable. Verse 9, but the olive tree said to them, should I cease giving my oil with which they honor God and men to go and sway over trees? Now the trees are the people that are coming to the fruit trees to nominate them to rule over them. And the fruit trees are telling the non-fruit bearing trees, and in one sense, all trees bear fruit. That's how they continue to exist. The acorn is the fruit of an oak, for example, but they're not, it's not a crop. You can't eat, and I'm told you can eat an acorn if you know how to prepare it, and it's quite dramatic, but let's just go with you can't eat an acorn and not suffer consequence. So verse 10, then the tree said to the fig, you come and reign over us. So the olive tree said, I'm not interested. So they're going down the list. Okay, let's try and find a fig tree. And they figured out where a fig tree was. And he says, verse 11, but the fig tree said to them, should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit and go sway over trees? This is a masterpiece of a parable. The quality and value of these trees, they're not measured by size. They're measured by their fruit, by their contribution to life. I don't know. I love olive oil. And I'm not big on the figs, but there's other fruit that you could substitute, like cherries or something, peaches. So anyway, but they make this contribution. And they would be distracted from what they were created for, what they are ordained to do, even anointed to do. They would be distracted from serving their God-given purpose if they were just to listen to anybody, no matter how noble the nomination might appear. Should I stop serving God and care about those who don't care about God's system? I don't want to have sway over the cares of the world. In verse 12, he says, then the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. Well, the fig tree said no. The olive tree said no. I have always felt, since I've been a Christian, that it's a step down for a pastor to leave his pulpit for politics. I think it's not only a step, it's not like a step down a step. It's a step down an abyss. And yet they do it. They think they get a following of people in a church that then qualifies them. And somebody gets hold of their ear, you'd make a good senator the way you deliver your points. Oh, boy. And the flattery just pours on them. We need more godly men in pulpits. We need godly people in politics, but not at the cost of our pulpits. The pulpits should contribute to producing fruitful characters who have what it takes to hold public office and survive on that salary at the same time. Well, verse 12, then the tree said to the vine, you come and reign over us. These are distractions from greater things to lesser things. That's what the trees in this parable, this is what he's saying. He's getting to the point. He's getting to Abimelech. He's not lost sight at all. He's just building this up. He's saying there are those characters that are not distracted from what they're supposed to be doing, not moving from greater things to lesser things. Nehemiah, you got to love Nehemiah. They tried to, oh, Nehemiah, come, we need to meet with you. We need to talk to you about all this work you're doing. He knew what they were up to. So I sent messengers to them, Nehemiah 6:3, saying, I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? Punk. I just got to love Nehemiah. Then Luke chapter 10, Jesus speaking, but before he speaks, we'll just take what Luke records. But Martha was distracted with much serving. It's a trap. If you are a diligent servant, you've got to put all sorts of guards out against possessing the ministry, against, you know, being competitive, and against working so hard that no one can challenge you, that without me, the whole thing stops. That is the devil feeding the flesh. You have to have a servant's heart and say, I serve the master. If he says go, I go. If he says stop, I stop. That is how it has got to be. It is the best system we know in this life. Everything else is a recipe for disaster. And we see it over and over again. Sometimes you have a good servant and they may mess up something and someone just pointed out to them and they can't handle it. They think they're above correction or reproach. I don't like someone pointing out my message. I mean, not my message. My mistakes. It's not pleasant. So we work hard to not let it happen. And if it should happen, always have ready someone else to blame. Kidding. Psalm 119, verse 37. Turn away my eyes from looking at worthless things and revive me in your way. Well, that's the illustration of these three trees that Jotham has presented to us. They are fruitful and they will not be distracted from being fruitful because you think they should go do something else. Verse 13, but the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and men, and go sway over trees? I like the translators doing that. I'm not trying to sway over people. I'm trying to be fruitful in what I was called to do. And so it teaches this fable that he is presenting to them that temptations will come and they will sound very sweet and make us feel useful or fruitful, but they're outside of what we're called to do. And even as they came to these trees, the temptations, regardless again of what shape they come in, they're outside our purpose. And it helps as a believer to know what your purpose is and do that. Stay focused on what your purpose is. As Spurgeon also said once, if you're going to be the second fiddle, be the best second fiddler there is. And not trying to, oh, I'm going to be first. Just concentrate on your calling. And so he pictures the trees looking for a king among the trees. And all of them refuse the nomination because each would have to sacrifice their calling, their appointment, in order to rule over people. And it's not what they wanted to do. They were not willing to make that sacrifice. But the bramble, the bramble would be king without dignity. He had no such conviction and no such purpose. He was unworthy, he was unqualified, he was unfruitful, and he was unkind as a person, as is the bramble. The wicked qualifications mean nothing, only ambition. Get that power, what can you do for me, and what have you done for me lately? The fruit trees, not leaving their sweet appointments, that message has now been said by Jotham in front of everybody. And of course, as we look around, we see the political world, we see that it has offers much power. And the wicked go towards power. They want the power, whereas many of the righteous, they're not after power, they're after success and fruitfulness and fulfillment and usefulness. And so many very qualified people, they would never run for office. They would occupy themselves with other things. Verse 14, then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. Look at that. So they settle for, all right, fine. The other trees, the oaks, the sycamores, the cedars, the elms, they come to the bramble, which is a shrub. They'll settle for a useless ruler over them. And we see this in politics all the time. We're just talking about the last Sunday, some of us were talking that in Georgia some time back, their candidate was in a mental institution and he won the election from a mental institution without even running him while he was out of his mind. This is madness. So the trees were persistent in the parable, ready to be satisfied with the bramble king. These are the people of Shechem. This is what he's saying. The bramble is a thorn bush. It's useless except as kindlewood. It's no crop. It is no wood that you can gain from it to make furniture or weapons or anything. It's just good to kindle fires, and sometimes in the summer months it catches fire and it causes destruction to the other trees or people or people's interests, crops, for example. It was a menace. And Psalm 58 translates the same word as thorns. This bramble bush was a thorny bush. It's a compliment to say to someone, you're an oak, or you're as beautiful as an elm. Have you ever seen an elm tree? I've only seen them in pictures, knowing what I'm looking at, a beautiful tree. But so this, again, this powerful image, verse 15, then the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. This is prophetic. He's speaking under the anointing. That's why we wish we knew more about this man, Jotham. But the bramble said to the trees, this Abimelech says to the people, this shrub, this useless shrub, says to the citizens, if you anoint me king, I'll bring you under my shade. And in the parable, Jotham is saying, is this a joke? You have no shade to offer trees. You're a shrub. Can you imagine? You know, your rose bush saying to an oak, come under my shade. It would be like a possum saying to a pride of lions, come under my authority and I'll protect you. It is a nuisance, this thorn bush. And once on fire, it's a problem. And so he says in the parable, let fire come out of the bramble. Symbol of Abimelech, their new king. And he is going to be very much involved in destructive fire. And he also will perish. And where he says the cedars of Lebanon, in this at the bottom of verse 15, but if not, let the fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. Those are the people of Shechem. And they will be devoured by the fire kindled by Abimelech. And we'll come to that in just a little bit. And so he says, at the bottom of verse 15, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. And it is, again, prophetic. Verse 16, now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Zerubbabel and his house, and have done him as he deserves, for my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian. But if you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed his 70 sons on one stone, and made Abimelech the son of his female servant king over the men of Shechem because he is your brother. And we'll just pause there. So he stopped with the parable. Verse 16 begins his statement to the men of Shechem, the citizens of Shechem from Mount Gerizim. And events will prove his words accurate and prophetic. Now is a good time to read Proverbs 19:10. Luxury is not fitting for a fool, much less a servant, to rule over princes. That's the connection that Jotham is making by saying, this man you're making king is the son of a servant to a king. And you should know better. That is saying that his low status has not prepared him for such a task. As a side note, the Bible never presents polygamy as a virtuous quality, is something to be practiced. It always shows the consequence of it, and it's unfortunate that it took so long to get a handle on this. Verse 19, if then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Zerubbabel and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. So he dares them to justify their deeds. You think this is good? You think this slaughter of the children of this hero of the nation is somehow noble? Okay, then you run with that. You're going to pay, though. That's the point. And so he's chopped down Abimelech, saying, you're nothing but a shrub. You wish you could be as fruitful as others, but you're not. And if you people are satisfied with this kind of king, you get the king you deserve. That's how he's closing this up. Verse 20, but if not, let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. And in other words, they're going to be on a disastrous course once these fires are lit. And that will come out in the story. Unfortunately, Jotham is talking to the wall, brick wall. They're not, well, you know, we don't know. There are people in the audience during these events when the righteous stand up and preach that may have genuinely been moved by these things, but the attention is placed on the key characters. And so we know that to this day is the case. A man can give a sermon or you can preach in the office place of someone. Someone overhears you and is moved enough to move to the Lord. And you may never know. Many times you never know. Who is being impacted by just being a righteous preacher or a preacher of righteousness. So we otherwise the stories are just depressing and not realistic, because the realistic factor is that people get saved from hearing people say things that are righteous. Faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. Well, verse 21, then Jotham ran away and fled, and he went to Beer and dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. How tragic. He ran from his brother because his brother was a mass murderer. Verse 22, and Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years. Again, no evidence that his reign really extended. We don't know where Beer is, as mentioned in verse 21, but we have no evidence of his authority really spilling out, and the writer just maybe just throwing that out there to say, you know, he nobody contested he was king, but you'd be hard to make a case for it. You don't see her about, you know, the coronation of Judah came and Ephraim came and the tribes. You don't have any of that you see, and of course, when Saul and David are coronated. Verse 23, Well, in fact, when Saul was coronated, there were those protesters. We're not going to have this guy rule over us. Verse 23, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbabel might be settled and their blood be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who aided him in the killing of his brothers. Several times, three or four times in this chapter, we read, it brought up the 70 that were killed, the 70, because this was, of course, a horrific event. The shielding that Abimelech would have had, had he been God anointed and appointed, is not there. It's absent. And within 3 years, of relative success, relative to what's coming, is collapsing. God permitted the natural tendencies of these characters to run their course. He didn't put no stops in place. This guy over here is a creep, and this guy over here is a creep, and I'm going to let them go together because that's what those kind of people do. Birds of a feather flock together, and they're going to get together, and they're going to turn on Abimelech, and I'm not going to stop it. And that's what's going on. Isaiah 66, verse 4, God speaking to the prophet, "So I will choose their delusions and bring their fears on them, because when I called, no one answered. When I spoke, they did not hear. But they did evil before my eyes and chose that in which I do not delight." They chose it. They didn't care about what God says. We read these words, and when we stumble, we say, "But Lord, I do care, and I don't want to stumble." Well, the wicked don't care. They don't make that prayer. They're not interested in what offends God, unless they think he's going to punish them. But still, they really don't care what God thinks. They don't have a relationship with him. Before I became a Christian, I didn't care what the Bible said. But now it's a whole other story. Verse 25, "And the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along the way, and it was told Abimelech." The men of Shechem set men in ambush against him. What do you mean him? It's not Abimelech riding through here being ambushed. It's his interest. This was a trade route. And unrest stirred up in Shechem. Abimelech's not living in Shechem at this time. And they're hitting the trade routes, which means they're taking his tariffs, the money he's getting from these caravans going through. The trust of the people is being challenged. The coming under the shade of his wings, of the shade of his branches, it's not working. He's 5 miles from Shechem, and that'll come out in verse 41, in Aruma. Not it's a rumor, but Aruma is the name of the village where he is. And so the Bramble King is losing money. He's losing control. He's not protecting. He's not offering relief, the shade that he promised. Verse 26. Now, Gaal, the son of Eab, and they'll repeat that enough times, just for me. They just did it for me. "Came with his brothers and went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him." So here's an upstart going to come on the scene now. Gaal. Another opportunist, but he's not as successful as Abimelech in his unprincipled ways. Him and his buddies, they're probably the ones robbing all who pass by along the way. He's probably got his hands in it. Anyway, verse 27, "So they went out into the field and gathered grapes from their vineyards and trod them and made merry. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech." So their vineyards, as some pronounce it, produced this fruit for them. Because after all, the vines didn't run for office. Okay. This is now July, June, July, the grape harvest, time when armies go out to war also. But again, alcohol is influencing these individuals. They have their harvest. They've made their grapes. They wait for it to ferment and do what it does. And Then they start drinking it, and the inhibitors are gone, and they start vocalizing their resentment towards Abimelech, and they do it publicly. They're railing against him, and now that's the beginning of the end for them. Verse 28, then Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, who is Abimelech, and who is Shechem, that we should serve him? Is not the son of Jerubbaal and his, is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him? And so Gaal here argues that these guys are not Canaanites. They're not from Shechem. They don't belong here. They're outsiders. How'd they get here? Who is this guy? And I've already mentioned, you know, Simeon and Levi hundreds of years ago and what happened here, the history. They're still mindful of these things. You know, there'd be folks still, you know, arguing the Civil War. If humanity went on another 2,000 years, they should still be arguing. And that's every Civil War probably. You still have their, you know, people just not forget. So they're railing against Abimelech, and they also go against his deputy, Zebul. And he's in Shechem there. He's going to get word of this. It's going to come back to bite them. And instead of saying, you know, Abimelech is incompetent and doesn't care about us, they go with his ancestry. He does. He's not one of us. It's all messed up. Verse 29, if only this people were under my authority. Here we go. You just want to roll your eyes when you hear that. This is Absalom at the gate. Those people that come into a church try to steal flocks, steal people over to their Bible study. It's the same. They do this. Believe it or not, I have no shame in doing it. As, you know, they used to hang horse thieves for a reason. Some things are very important, and you shouldn't mess with them. What he is doing, these guys, they're sealing their own fate. He says, if only this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech. And so he said to Abimelech, increase your army and come out. See? You don't mean that, do you? In other words, he sent a message to Abimelech, I'm challenging your authority on the battlefield. We're going to fight this out. Verse 30, then Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed. His anger was aroused. Yeah, because they cursed him too. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly saying, take note, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem. And here they are fortifying the city against you. Why, I'm so glad that they don't name Gaal's brothers and behind each brother say, the son of Ebed. But verse 32, now therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. So Zebul is in Shechem. He's the governor or the deputy of Abimelech. He hears all this. He sends a note to Abimelech. They're challenging you to a fight. You need to get here quickly. You know, move at night and lay low until sunrise and then pounce. That's his advice in verse 33. And it shall be... as soon as the sun is up in the morning, that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you may do to them as you find opportunity. So the informant blows the whistle, and he also, he's not really an informant, I mean, he's an official of Abimelech, but he blows the whistle and he gives instruction. And again, Abimelech is in Aruma, so he's, not too far, 5 miles or so. Verse 34, so Abimelech and all the people who were with him rose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. I should have counted how many times I'm going to read Shechem in this chapter. It's kind of a fun word to say, so I'm not really complaining. It could be worse. Abimelech, the people who... Why isn't there better language here? Somebody else must have taken chapter 9, and that was their assignment. They divided it up between the professors. Okay, you'll get this. Because the men, the soldiers, the people. It makes it sound like, you know, just there's high schoolers out there. You know, everybody's out on the battlefield, and that's not the case. These are the men of war. Anyway, so Abimelech, verse 34, and all the people who were with him arose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. Then Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance to the city gate. Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from lying in wait. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, phonetically it sounds like we're saying other words, look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains. And Zebul said to him, you see the shadows of the mountains as if they were men. Well, he's deliberately stalling, giving more time to Abimelech's troops to converge on the city before Gaal rings the alarm. Verse 37, so Gaal spoke again and said, see, people are coming down from the center of the land. And another company is coming down from the diviner's Tiberith tree. Verse 38, and Zebul said to him, where indeed is your mouth now with which you said, who is Abimelech, that we should serve him, and not these people whom you despise? Go out, if you will, and fight with them now. So Zebul, it sounds like poor, like I'm saying, you know, the bull. Zebul, anyway, he's taunting Gaal, and he's saying, well, you've been talking all this, you know, talk, now is your chance to put up or shut up. And so he doesn't have a choice. He's got to fight or just be killed. He can't run back. He's got to, they're too close. He's got to do something. Verse 39, so Gaal went out leading the men of Shechem and fought with Abimelech, and Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him, and many fell wounded to the very entrance of the gate. That's the gate of Shechem. Then Abimelech dwelt in Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brothers so that they would not dwell in Shechem. Verse 42, and it came about on the next day that the people went out into the field and they told Abimelech, and that's Abimelech's troops. So he took his people, divided them into three companies, and lay in wait in the field. He looked, and there were the people coming out of the city, and he rose against them and attacked them. So the Shechemites are launching a counterattack. And Abimelech got word of it, so he put people in place for this, and he's ready for them. Verse 44, then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city. And the other two companies rushed upon all who were in the fields and killed them. So that's the end of that battle. Verse 45, so Abimelech fought against the city all day. He took the city and killed the people who were in it, and he demolished the city and sowed it with salt. It's hard to sow with salt. The fabric just doesn't stay together. So this spreading salt over the land is symbolic, because you'd need an excavator and dump trucks to come in and actually put salt all over the place, so much so that nothing could ever grow there again. It's a symbolic gesture. It's just not practical. I know some commentators will say but just think about it. How much milky spore would it take to put in your backyard if you've ever tried that? So you got to mine the salt, be a waste of salt. Just not practical. So it's a symbolic gesture that I condemn this city and nobody's to come back here. That is the idea in this case of doing it. Now, again, it's one of those not so important points that if you want to argue, it's not worth arguing. But as I'm reading it as a Bible student, I'm in my head trying to picture this. How much salt would it take to really ruin the soil so that nothing would grow there? You'd need lots of salt. And anyway, so we move on to verse 46. And now when all the men of the tower of Shechem had heard that they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Beerith, verse 47, and it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together. Perhaps they were thinking, you know, they run into the strong tower, that's a fortified position, a bunch of stones make this elevated structure. And they feel relatively safe there, and it's a temple, so they feel that he's not going to, maybe he won't bother them because it's a religious shrine. Of course, he's going to turn it into a furnace and kill them all. Verse 48, Abimelech went up to Mount Zalman, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a bough of the tree and took it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What you have seen me do, make haste and do as I have done." So some believe this all is covered over 3 days or so. I think it's a little bit more than that, but not very much more. And that would lend to, you know, you can't bring the carts of salt in also. So what he does is he takes the people and by leading by example, he chops down a bough and he drags it to the, instead of just saying, giving the order, go chop up some branches and bring them so we can set this stuff on fire. It's kind of dramatic. But he says, what you see me do, you do it, and let's hurry up and get it done. So they're going to pile all this brush around the tower, and they're going to set it on fire, and they're going to smoke out and burn up those inside this tower. Verse 49, so each of the people likewise cut down his own bough and followed Abimelech, put them against the stronghold, and set the stronghold on fire above them, so that all the people of the tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. That's pretty intense. They had to be packed in that place to begin with, and they had nowhere to get out. And whoever did not burn up died from lack of oxygen or inhaling the smoke. And this is the parable, just as Jotham's parable prophesied, let fire come from Abimelech in verse 20. The bramble king. The bramble is good for nothing but kindling fires. And that's just what the parable was so spot on. And he destroys those who supported the coup. And the curse is partly fulfilled. Remaining is the death of Abimelech. Verse 50, and Abimelech went to Thebez, and encamped against Thebez and took it. Apparently, Thebez joined the rebellion with Shechem, and we just have to connect that dot. Verse 51, but there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people of the city, fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower. Thebez had to have heard the story. So Thebez does something a little differently. They're going to take a millstone, and they're going to break it up. Again, you have to think through this. Millstones, even the upper millstones, they're not light. And just seeing somebody tug it up a tower and then some lady pick it up and throw it over the side is not realistic. And I've got evidence for that. But because you look at this, what's a millstone doing on top of the tower? They're not hiding out, you know, milling stuff up there, are they? No, it's a piece of a millstone. And I'll get that out. My point is, they heard about what happened. They're planning. If he comes up next to this wall, we're going to be throwing stuff down on his head. I like that about these Thebezians. They're like, were there any Thesbians in Thebez? I don't know. Anyway, they weren't acting. Verse 51, but there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women and all the people of the city fled there and shut themselves in. Then they went up to the top of the tower, verse 52. So Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it, and he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. So he says, look, this just worked in Shechem. This is going to work like a charm, guys. Watch this. He's writing the military manual of the Jews to how not to fight against a fortified position. Verse 53. But a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. Well, if it were the whole millstone, he would not have survived, likely, to say to somebody anything. It would have just killed him. But she throws off this piece of a millstone. It clunks him. He knows he's going to die. This, again, finds its way into the military manual of Israel's tactics against fortifications, because David, in his shameful execution of Uriah, tells Joab, pull close to the tower, to the city walls, to the fortification, But leave Uriah there. And, Joab sends the message back to David that Uriah was killed. We attacked the wall. And David says, why do you? Well, let me just read it. 2 Samuel 11, verse 21. It says, who struck Abimelech, the son of Jerubbesheth? That's a variation of Jerubbabel. Was it not a woman who cast a piece of a millstone? You see, there's the clue. Because it just bugged me. I mean, how do you get a millstone? Who takes it up there? That's like, you know, I don't know. It's like taking a wheelbarrow on an airplane. It just doesn't belong there. Clunking into the people in first class, not a good start. Anyhow, who cast a piece of a millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes. That's what it says in 2 Samuel 11:21. Now, you may say, this really doesn't do anything for me. Sorry, I like it. Kind of stuff. I got to see the realities because that's where the lessons are. That's how we learn. And when we, you know, make up things or see things that just aren't practical, I think we get into trouble. And so if something is, you know, pressing on you when you read, and say, I need to find the answer out, then that's not bad. Verse 54. And he called quickly to a young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, draw your sword, kill me, lest men say of me, a woman killed him. So the young men thrust him through, and he died. Well, again, he said to a young, they must have dragged him away because I'm not coming near you. This might have more millstone pieces up there. I don't want to be lying next to you. When he says, draw your sword, I would have said, this is no time for artwork. I like that one. Anyway, what a wasted life. Here's the Bramble King. Nothing good recorded about him. The triple disgrace of his day. He's not killed in battle, technically. I mean, he was, but not by a sword. He wasn't in a sword fight. He got it. And the fact that in his society, of course, being killed by anybody is not good. But anyhow, that was a disgrace as a soldier. And he was killed by a piece of millstone, a farmer's tool, and not even the whole thing. So, you know, he calculated all this very quickly in his dying breath. just kill me, okay? And the armor bearer, unlike Saul's armor bearer who hesitated, he's no, listen, this would be an honor because I never liked you. Verse 55, and when the men of Israel saw Abimelech was dead, they departed every man to his place. Now, what's probably not quoted is the song they were singing, something to the tune of Ding Dong, Abimelech's dead. Verse 56, thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers, and all the evil of the men of Shechem. God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbabel. And so the curse from verse 20 of chapter 9 is fulfilled, and both Abimelech and the people of Shechem were dealt with, and it is a tragedy. But that's our story. We will roll forward, Lord willing, with chapter 9. Went a little long tonight, so that's the price. Let's pray. Our Father, to be faced with the wickedness and to temptations to be distracted, and may we be clear in our calling wherever you may have us at the time. And may we see distractions for what they are, as distractions. And may we work on remaining committed to our purpose and to be fruitful. And may you get those of us who are in the church this evening home safely. In Jesus' name we ask you these things. Amen.